Good morning and welcome to JFK Spotlight on Health. This is, as you know, where we highlight the groundbreaking work being done at JFK University Medical Center in Edison. It's part of the Hackensack Meridian Health Network. This week, our guest is Dr. Michael Lasser, a return appearance. Actually, I think more than once before we've had him on the program. Medical Director of Robotic Surgery at JFK University Medical Center in Edison. Good morning, doctor.
Hi there. Happy to be here, Joel. Thank you.
Good to have you back. I guess you've done this like two or three times, I understand.
I've been here a couple times.
Yeah, I know that we had a chat, I guess, a little over a year ago, but here we are again. So let's jump right in. We're going to examine multiple topics, and we'll start with everyone's favorite, benign prostatic hyperplasia, or BPH. Let's go with the first question as, what's that?
Well, I don't know if it's everyone's favorite one, but it's definitely a common problem. So I'm the medical director of robotic surgery, but also a urologist by trade. So when we see patients in the office, a lot of the time it's not just robotic surgery. We're talking about the standard urologic symptoms and problems, and BPH is one of the most common. If you look at the statistics out there, people in their 30s and 40s, up to 10% of people have some symptoms. And as they get older, it gets more prominent, up to 80% of people in their 80s. And what this is first you have to kind of know what the prostate is, right? A lot of people have no idea what that is. So the prostate's a male sexual organ. It basically sits in front of the bladder and urine runs through it. So as it gets bigger, as we age, it eventually creates difficulty with urine passage and urinary symptoms, such as waking up at night, difficulty with emptying your bladder,
right.
Low stream or urinary frequency. And basically that conglomerate of what we call urinary symptoms is what BPH causes.
Okay, so how does it come about? You're saying it causes that. What causes you to have BPH?
So BPH, as you age, your prostate gets larger.
Oh, okay.
And testosterone, males have testosterone. People with prostates have testosterone. And what ends up happening is that the testosterone causes the prostate to enlarge as you age, and as it gets bigger, it eventually causes more difficulty with the urine getting out of the bladder. And as the bladder works harder and harder, it develops more and more symptomatology. So I like to explain it to my patients in this way. I tell them, listen, if you ever go to the gym and you work out too hard, your arm muscles, maybe they're not going to work as well the next day. It's the same idea. Over time, trying to push the urine out, over many, many years, eventually the bladder tires and it becomes more difficult to urinate and you develop more and more symptoms.
Okay, so it sounds like the main issue is with the bladder wearing out. What can we do about that? Or what do you do about that?
Right, it's the bladder having to work harder to get past the problem. Mm-hmm. So the first step is always, talking to someone about behavioral changes, things that can cause it. So, we know that obesity, poor diet, lack of exercise, diabetes, all these things can potentially contribute. So trying to maintain a healthy lifestyle, a healthy diet, and exercising on a regular basis tends to help. Now, if you exhaust those options, the first step is medications. People have heard of these things such as Flomax. That's a common name out there, and it's been around forever. And it's a catchy name. Yeah, people hear about it because it's a catchy name, but essentially what it does is relaxes the muscles in the prostate, making it easier for urine to pass. And there's a whole bunch of medications in that class, not just that one medication. And that's our first step, always trying the medication. If that helps, great. People stay on it for a long period of time. But once that starts to fail, we have a number of surgical options out there for treatment of an enlarged prostate.
Okay.
And we can get into them if you'd like.
Sure. Yeah, I would. So what would be the first, let's say the medication really isn't doing the job, is there an order, as far as the surgeries are concerned, is there one that you would try first? That doesn't work, you try the next one? And what would be the first?
Yeah, that's a very appropriate question, because at least in my practice, I always try and employ the least invasive option, right? You want to cause the least amount of harm you can. So there's now a number of treatments that are considered what we call minimally invasive options. So you may have heard some. There's some advertising out there, something called UroLift. There's something called Rezum. Essentially what these are is where we use specific techniques to decrease the size of the prostate where it counts in the urinary stream. UroLift is a procedure where we put what's called UroLift devices, almost like little staples, into the prostate to pinch it open, allowing the urine to pass more freely and alleviating your symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's something called Rezum, where we use hot steam to kind of melt away that same area of prostate tissue in the urinary tract, therefore making it easier to pass urine. And those are really some of the least invasive options out there. So a lot of the time, that's our first go-to surgical option if someone is an appropriate candidate.
Now, you don't know beforehand, and I guess obviously it's like this with most surgeries, you don't know if it's going to work or not, and you're going to have to move on to the next thing to try.
I always counsel everyone that there's always the option of minimally invasive options, and once we use them, most people do great with them. But if they fail, there are other options we can use. But it's important to note that, obviously, if someone's going through this and having these types of bothersome urinary symptoms, the first step is meeting with a doctor who takes care of these, a urologist, and you can go through a number of different studies, such as what we call a cystoscopy, where we look inside and check the anatomy, something that studies the function of the bladder, we check the size of the prostate. And you really want to make sure that you've had the proper workup so that you can go into this saying, you have the best chance of this procedure working. And if we do some of that workup and we identify that maybe we have found something that makes you less likely to respond well, maybe we move on to a different option.
Right. Okay, good. That was my next question. I was kind of going to word it differently, so I thought it would sound a little weird. But let's say you have three surgical options, and you're going to go with the non-invasive one first, which is number one, and then number two, and number... What if I'm somebody who says, listen, I don't want to try all these other ones. Let's just do the last one so we know it's going to work, and let's do that. Is that ever... Has anyone ever asked to do that, or does that make any kind of sense whatsoever?
No, it's rare to have someone come in and say, listen, I want the most invasive procedure you can get.
I didn't mean it like that. I meant, I don't want to be trial and erroring till I get to the one that works. Right. Let's just do the best one, no matter what it takes.
Yeah, so luckily these procedures have been around for a long time, been studied, and we know that they have a really good track record.
Okay.
So what I was getting at before is kind of the workup leading to surgical options is important. Checking the anatomy, checking the function of the bladder, and once you have all that information, you can kind of counsel someone regarding, hey, you have a really good chance of one of the minimally invasive options working, or maybe you don't, your prostate's too large, and we really have to move on to something else.
Okay,
if you'd make a step beyond that minimally invasive category, there's more invasive options. There's something called a TURP, which is a Roto-Rooter procedure, is how most people think of it or have been described it. Where we go in and instead of using these options to melt away or pinch back the prostate tissue, we actually scrape out that excess abnormal growth of prostate tissue that's blocking the flow of urine, allowing the urine to flow more freely and alleviating a lot of symptoms. It's a more invasive procedure, but it's really been around for decades and decades and it's been used countless times with really good outcomes. There's also something called a laser prostatectomy where we use a laser to do the same thing, basically destroy prostate tissue. And there's different ways of doing these, but essentially that's one of the mainstays of treatment of an enlarged prostate. It was around way before we had these minimally invasive options. And if someone has a really big prostate or fit has several different clinical factors that make them less likely to respond even to that, there's something called a simple prostatectomy. Now, the word simple is kind of misleading.
Yeah, that sounds good. Simple. That sounds better than Roto-Rooter.
Right. Simple prostatectomy sounds good. It just means that it's a surgery not for cancer, but what we do is we go in and actually surgically remove all the abnormal growth of the prostate as one entity. Instead of scraping it out, we go in and kind of core out the abnormal growth of the prostate. We used to do this open with a big cut, and people would be in the hospital anywhere from 2 to 5 days, and nowadays we do it robotically, which is something that I do, and we've really seen a paradigm shift where now you can offer this biggest, most invasive option robotically, and people are out of the hospital in 1 or 2 nights, and they do great.
Now, I've had doctors on talk about robotics specifically, but for those who haven't caught those programs, could you just quickly explain that the robotics, it's not like the doctor leaves the room and the robot takes over. Could you just give a quick explanation of how that works? And I also want to find out about what the pain is involved with the different techniques that you spoke about earlier. Why don't we touch on that first, and then you can tell us about the robotics very quickly.
So we're lucky that the prostate doesn't have a lot of pain sensors, but you can get pressure in the pelvis. You can get urinary symptoms like urgency and frequency while you're healing from any of these. Once we get to the more invasive, like the robotic procedures where you have cutting of the skin, we get some pain from the incisions, but we're fortunate that the vast majority of procedures for the prostate are very, very well tolerated.
Okay. Well, that's good news, because I know when you're talking, when you're using terms like Roto-Rooter, you know, the idea, okay, wait a second, what's, you were talking about my prostate now, this isn't my arm. So I would think that many people listening are thinking, what's going on there? So that's actually, that sounds not bad.
Yeah, no, it's, we do it a lot in urology. These procedures have been around for a long time, and we're fortunate that we have really good outcomes in most scenarios. So we get to offer real improvement for a lot of patients with not a lot of risk in most scenarios. So, you know, obviously it's a worthwhile discussion to have with your doctor if you're having these symptoms about all the options that are available and which ones might be the best option for you individually.
Talking with Dr. Michael Lasser, Medical Director of Robotic Surgery at JFK University Medical Center. We're talking about the prostate right now, and we'll move on to prostate cancer screenings. But very briefly, just give a rundown of how the robotics works. It's not the robot is doing the work, but it's being controlled by the doctor, correct?
That's correct. You know, I've talked about robotic surgery a lot as the Medical Director of Robotic Surgery at JFK University Medical Center. We started our program in 2016. We've done thousands of procedures. We're expanding actively. And one thing that we've noted is that as we grow, we have a focus on patient safety. And what comes with patient safety is really letting patients know what this system is, right? And the robotic system that we use is the same one that's used basically across the country. It is not something that is autonomous or it doesn't think for itself. It's a surgical tool, just like any other surgical tool that a surgeon can use. This is what we call minimally invasive surgery, just like something people may have heard of as laparoscopic surgery, where we operate with small little cuts, use instruments to perform the procedure. The difference is that with robotic surgery, we're able to basically use 10-time zoom and sit at a console where we can see in three-dimensional imaging everything that's happening inside the patient, and use our hands to manipulate the instruments as if we're using our hands inside the patient. However, we're using something that's teeny tiny, about a centimeter in size instead of an entire human hand. Mm-hmm. So it really allows us to accomplish complicated surgery with very small incisions and much better precision for better outcomes overall. And as I said, the surgeon is in control all the time. There's never any autonomous movement by the robot. It's simply a very advanced surgical tool we use.
And you can see better because you can zoom in.
Yeah, yeah, there's 10 times zoom. So we not only do we have that, but you also have a three-dimensional view. It's an amazing instrument. It's really revolutionized our ability to do more complex surgery with less pain, faster recovery, and lower risk to the patients. We used to have to do this with big cuts and big surgery.
Right.
Now we can transition them to very, very small incisions and get people out of the hospital much, much faster.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to ask you. So in your experience, when you used to do it the old way and then you were switching to the new way, obviously there's a learning curve, but were you just like blown away how much, you know, more precise and safer, I would imagine, that this is and just made your job easier and I guess safer is the word that keeps coming to mind because it's just very precise and it's going to get it right.
Yeah, it's the same surgery, just done with more precision and better view. And
yeah,
what we've seen is as you were getting at in that comment, is that, you know, when we used to do it open, we'd get people through surgery, people would do great, but we would notice that you'd lose blood, maybe be in the hospital for a longer period of time, or just couldn't see the structures with that degree of microscopic precision. So now, as we transition, for instance, one of the greatest areas as we're about to transition into prostate cancer talk, when we do prostate cancer surgery and remove someone's prostate for prostate cancer, there's nerves that control what we call potency or erectile function, and they're tiny, right? They're microscopic features. When we did it open, we would just kind of identify where they're supposed to be and save them. However, robotically, with this 10 times magnification, we can actually identify the exact spot where they are and make sure we're saving as much as possible. So, yeah, it's a huge change. It's a paradigm shift, and I don't see anything ever reverting back to the open surgery. Obviously, there's people who aren't candidates for it, so that's why the discussion with your surgeon is very important. But for me, it's absolutely a useful and great instrument that we use to help patients.
Yeah, it sounds like it's either holding an old photograph and looking at that and bringing it up to your face if you want to see it closer, or you're on your phone and you just spread your fingers and you can zoom right in on a spot and see exactly what's going on.
That's a great analogy, actually.
All right.
I'll use that in the future.
Yeah, all right, feel free. talking with Dr. Michael Lasser, Medical Director, Robotic Surgery, JFK University Medical Center, erectile dysfunction. A lot of guys suffer from this. It's something that seems to have been remedied over the past several years. Where are we now, and what can we do to prevent it or treat it?
Well, it's very common, right? ED, as we call it, most commonly is an incredibly common problem. If you look at the numbers out there, it's about, 52% of males at some point, will have some degree of erectile dysfunction, right? So at some point, you'll see it in 50%. You're flipping a coin there. The statistics are that it's more common as you get older. So, you're talking about, between the ages of 40 and 70 is when it occurs most commonly. It's really most commonly a problem with blood flow. Erections happen because blood flows into the penis and it gets erect. That's how it works. It's a plumbing problem. If you don't have enough inflow, it doesn't work as well. And so the risk factors that are out there for it can be obesity, diabetes, cardiac disease, and there's a number of different things out there that can affect it. But as you said, over the decades and decades and decades of treating this, we really have come to having multiple different options. So first option is always the medications out there, right? Mm-hmm. If you can't get better and improve things by weight loss or exercise or healthy habits, you can try things like the classic blue pill people talk about, Viagra, et cetera. There's a whole bunch of them out there, and all of them are generic, and all of them are less expensive nowadays, which is really good, and that's fortunate for our patients. We used to prescribe these, and then it would be cost prohibitive. Luckily, now that's less common. And if the oral pills don't work, we have a number of options that we can talk about with patients, ranging from what we call low-intensity shockwave therapy, where we send shockwaves into the penis and can promote the generation of new arteries and better blood flow. We can talk about looking at testosterone levels. We can talk about injections. There's a ton of options out there. So most people, we can get back to functioning normally.
And when somebody is dysfunctioning, it could be that they can't get erect any time. Or is there some that's just like once in a while, and that seems to be something that needs to be treated as well?
Yeah, there's different types of erectile dysfunction. There's organic, where there's something wrong, lack of blood flow. There's something called venous leak, where the blood exits too fast. And then there's other things, neurologic, diabetes, spinal cord injuries, those types of things. And also there's something called psychogenic, where it doesn't happen all the time, but everything's functioning normally, but we have to kind of figure out what the problem is in certain situations. So it's very variable. That's why a discussion with your doctor is very important when you're talking about, you have to identify when it's happening in what specific situations, or is it all the time? As you said, those are treated very differently.
So I think you might have answered this question, but you mentioned all the possible reasons for the dysfunction, overweight, diabetes, and you mentioned a couple others, which I'm not recalling, but is there ever a time where there's nothing? There's really nothing that you can point to that could be the reason, yet it's still happening, and you have to search for a remedy for that?
Absolutely. We do see that in some young populations. You'll see a healthy person who comes in with some erectile dysfunction, and it can be a harbinger of underlying heart or cardiac problems. So you always say, hey, just go make sure there's nothing wrong that you can't see, right? Mm-hmm. Make sure you get evaluated by your medical doctor, make sure that everything's normal with your blood pressure, with your heart, get a good general medical screening. And then there's other elements where, as you said, we don't find anything at all, but it's still happening. And that can be, that can range from something from performance anxiety, having one bad situational outcome leads to thinking about it or overthinking it. Also to where just for some reason things aren't working well and we use medications in that scenario. And in most of these situations, we can find some way to help people get to a better functional status.
It's my understanding that with the pills, you need to take them when you are ready to get you ready for a sexual...
Yeah, there's different pills, and they're taken different ways, but most of them are on demand.
Right, on
an
demand.
An hour or two prior to activity.
Okay, an hour or two. So Sometimes you don't know, and sometimes it doesn't work out. Is there any type of pill that just fixes the issue, and it's just whenever you need it, it's there? Or
there's some daily dosing out there. So some of the medications have daily dosing, where it's a lower dose you can take every single day, and that can help some people. You know, a lot of people respond to that really well. It's challenging to always have to carry this on you, not know. Obviously, these are spontaneous events that occur, right?
Mm-hmm,
so
right.
It can be a little stressful to have to then carry this or know when to take it in advance. There's also other pills that last longer. Some of them can last up to 72 hours. So if you expect to have some activity or something happening over the weekend, maybe that's a good option for you. That's why the discussions are always an interesting one, where you talk to someone about their lifestyle, about what their goals are for treatment, and you can usually come up with a good outcome.
Okay, so to be clear, for those who have never taken it, and hopefully they won't ever have to deal with that, but if they do, these pills that last for 72 hours, that just gets you, if the situation should arise, you're ready. It's not like automatic and then you have an erection for 72 hours.
that's a good distinction. So taking it at 10 steps backwards, none of these medications, and this is a common misconception.
Okay.
None of these medications cause erections. So you don't take the pill and then you have an erection. What it does is that when you attempt to get ready and have an erection, they will help you to have a better one.
So, okay.
These should not, when you take it, automatically result in potency or an erection. Instead, they improve blood flow, and you still need to do everything you would normally do to get ready. However, these would allow you to achieve a better functional status when you're taking it.
Okay, I'm glad you said that, because as you said, a lot of people, it's a common misconception, and that's what I thought. When we're talking about, like, the blue pill, for example, I thought that, you know, it'll last 2 hours, whatever they say, that you're up for 2 hours.
Well, luckily that's not the case.
So, okay.
You know, something called priapism is an emergency. If it's ever up for more than 4 hours without sexual desire, that's actually can lead to permanent damage, and that's an emergency we tell people about when they're on these.
Okay.
However, that's very rare, and I've had many patients who come in, and we have this discussion, but that's kind of somehow lost. You know, people don't retain everything we talk about, and they say, hey, I took it, nothing happened. Well, did you try? Well, no, isn't it just supposed to cause it?
Right.
And so I'm really happy you brought that up, because this is a good forum to get that kind of information out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what I thought. I've never had to take it, and that's how I thought it worked. And as you said, it's a common misconception, so I'm not the only one. Are there any other common misconceptions involved with this dysfunction?
I guess it depends on the age of the person and what the clinical scenario is. There's always misconceptions. People think that, you know, once if you can't get it once, you'll never be able to get it again. Or that there's definitely something wrong with your organ if it's not working. You know, every person has a different concept as to what's happening. Everyone has a different concept as to and a different misconception. So it's always good to have this talk and have this type of information out there, because there's a lot of bad information out there. And when you sit down and talk to someone who treats it on a daily basis, they can kind of disprove a lot of the thoughts. I've heard distressing, you know, thought patterns that come out of, you know, reading things on Google, et cetera. So,
right.
So it's a good point. It's always worthwhile having that talk about all these different thought processes and what they've read, because there's a lot of bad information out there. There's also some good information out there.
All right. And for those listening, if you're just catching the tail end, you can go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com immediately after we sign off here with the program. It'll be up as a podcast there. So Dr. Michael Lasser, Medical Director of Robotic Surgery at JFK University Medical Center, thank you once again for your time.
Yeah, I appreciate you. Thank you for having me.
If you'd like more information, just go to jfkmc.org, or if you'd like a podcast of this show, you go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com. JFK Spotlight on Health is brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health. Keep getting better. I'm Joel Katz. We'll talk to you next week.